is Reading the Classics, and I'm Pat Tully of the Ketchikan Public Library. This evening I'll be reading an essay written by Oliver Wendell Holmes, Sr. The Sr. Holmes was a very popular essayist and raconteur in mid-19th century Boston. The essay I'm about to read was published in late 1861, near the beginning of the Civil War. Holmes' son and namesake, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., enlisted in the Union Army early in the war. He survived the war and was eventually named to the U.S. Supreme Court, dying in 1935 at the age of 93. Anyway, this essay is by his father, the elder Oliver Wendell Holmes. It's called Bread and the Newspaper. This is the new version of the Panem et Circenses of the Roman populace. It is our ultimatum, as that was theirs. They must have something to eat, and the circus shows to look at. We must have something to eat, and the papers to read. Everything else we can give up. If we're rich, we can lay down our carriages, stay away from Newport or Saratoga, and adjourn the trip to Europe sine die. If we live in a small way, there are at least new dresses and bonnets and everyday luxuries which we can dispense with. If the young zouave of the family looks smart in his new uniform, its respectable head is content, though he himself grows seedy as a caraway umble late in the season. He will cheerfully calm the perturbed nap of his old beaver hat by patient brushing in place of buying a new one, if only the lieutenant's jaunty cap is what it should be. We all take a pride in sharing the epidemic economy of the time. Only bread in the newspaper we must have, whatever else we do without. How this war is simplifying our mode of being. We live on our emotions, as the sick man is said in the common speech, to be nourished by his fever. Our ordinary mental food has become distasteful, and what would have been intellectual luxuries at other times are now absolutely repulsive. All this change in our manner of existence implies that we have experienced some very profound impression, which will sooner or later betray itself in permanent effects on the minds and bodies of many among us. We cannot forget Corvisart's observation on the frequency with which diseases of the heart were noticed as the consequence of the terrible emotions produced by the scenes of the great French Revolution. Laennec tells the story of a convent, of which he was the medical director, where all the nuns were subjected to the severest penances and schooled in the most painful doctrines. They all became consumptive soon after their entrance, so that in the course of his 10 years' attendance, all the inmates died out 2 or 3 times and were replaced by new ones. He does not hesitate to attribute the disease from which they suffered to those depressing moral influences to which they were subjective. So far, we have noticed little more than disturbances of the nervous system as a consequence of the war excitement in non-combatants. Take the first trifling example which comes to our recollection. A sad disaster to the Federal Army was told the other day in the presence of 2 gentlemen and a lady. Both the gentlemen complained of a sudden feeling at the epigastrium, or, less learnedly, the pit of the stomach, changed color, and confessed to a slight tremor about the knees. The lady had a grande révolution, as the French patients say, went home and kept her bed for the rest of the day. Perhaps the reader may smile at the mention of such trivial indispositions, but in more sensitive natures, death itself follows, in some cases, from no more serious cause. An old gentleman fell senseless in fatal apoplexy on hearing of Napoleon's return from Elba. One of our early friends, who recently died of the same complaint, was thought to have had his attack mainly in consequence of the excitements of the time. We all know what the war fever is in our young men, what a devouring passion it becomes in those whom it assails. Patriotism is the fire of it, no doubt, but this is fed with fuel of all sorts, the love of adventure, the contagion of example, the fear of losing the chance of participating in the great events of the time, the desire of personal distinction, all helped to produce those singular transformations which we often witness, turning the most peaceful of our youth into the most ardent of our soldiers. But something of the same fever, in a different form, reaches a good many non-combatants who have no thought of losing a drop of precious blood belonging to themselves or their family. Some of the symptoms we shall mention are almost universal. They are as plain in the people we meet everywhere as the marks of an influenza, when that is prevailing. The first is a nervous restlessness of a very peculiar character. Men cannot think or write or attend to their ordinary business. They stroll up and down the streets or saunter out upon the public places. We confessed to an illustrious author that we laid down the volume of his work, which we were reading when the war broke out. It was as interesting as a romance, but the romance of the past grew pale before the red light of the terrible present. Meeting the same author not long afterwards, he confessed that he had laid down his pen at the same time that we had closed his book. He could not write about the 16th century any more than we could read about it, while the 19th was in the very agony and bloody sweat of its great sacrifice. Another most eminent scholar told us in all simplicity that he had fallen into such a state that he would read the same telegraphic dispatches over and over again in different papers, as if they were new, until he felt as if he were an idiot. Who did not do just the same thing, and does not often do it still, now that the first flush of the fever is over? Another person always goes through the side streets on his way for the noon extra. He is so afraid that somebody will meet him and tell him the news he wishes to read, first on the bulletin board, and then in the great capitals and leaded type of the newspaper. When any startling piece of war news comes, it keeps repeating itself in our minds in spite of all we can do. The same trains of thought go tramping around in circle through the brain like the supernumeraries that make up the grand army of a stage show. Now, if a thought goes round the brain 1,000 times a day, it will have worn as deep a track as one that has passed through it once a week for 20 years. This accounts for the ages we seem to have lived through since the 12th of April last, and, to state it more generally, for that ex post facto operation of a great calamity, or any very powerful impression, which we once illustrated by the image of a stain spreading backwards from the leaf of life open before us through all those which we have already turned. Blessed are those who can sleep quietly in times like these. Yet not wholly blessed either, for what is more painful than the awakening from peaceful unconsciousness to a sense that there is something wrong? We cannot at first think what, and then groping our way about through the twilight of our thoughts until we come full upon the misery, which, like some evil bird, seemed to have flown away, but which sits waiting for us on its perch by our pillow in the gray of the morning. The converse of this is perhaps still more painful. Many have the feeling in their waking hours that the trouble they are aching with is, after all, only a dream. If they will rub their eyes briskly enough and shake themselves, they will awake out of it and find all their supposed grief is unreal. This attempt to cajole ourselves out of an ugly fact always reminds us of those unhappy flies who have been indulging in the dangerous sweets of the paper prepared for their special use. Watch one of them. He does not feel quite well, at least he suspects himself of indisposition. Nothing serious. Let us just rub our forefeet together, as the enormous creature who provides for us rubs his hands, and all will be right. He rubs them with that peculiar twisting movement of his and pauses for the effect. No, all is not quite right yet. Ah, it is our head that is not set on just as it ought to be. Let us settle that where it should be, and then we shall certainly be in good trim again. So he pulls his head about as an old lady adjusts her cap, and passes his forepaw over it like a kitten washing herself. Poor fellow, it is not a fancy, but a fact that he has to deal with. If he could read the letters at the head of the sheet, he would see that they were fly paper. So with us when, in our waking misery, we try to think we dream. Perhaps very young persons may not understand this. As we grow older, our waking and dreaming life run more and more into each other. Another symptom of our excited condition is seen in the breaking up of old habits. The newspaper is as imperious as a Russian ukase. It will be had, and it will be read. To this, all else must give place. If we must go out at unusual hours to get it, we shall go, in spite of after-dinner nap or evening somnolence. If it finds us in company, it will not stand on ceremony, but cut short the compliment and the story by the divine right of its telegraphic dispatches. War is a very old story, but it is a new one to this generation of Americans. Our own nearest relation in the ascending line remembers the Revolution well. How should she forget it? Did she not lose her doll, which was left behind when she was carried out of Boston, about that time growing uncomfortable by reason of cannonballs dropping in from the neighboring heights at all hours? In token of which we see the tower of Brattle Street Church at this very day. War in her memory means 76. As for the brush of 1812, we did not think much about that. And everybody knows that the Mexican business did not concern us much, except in its political relations. No, war is a new thing to all of us who are not in the last quarter of their century. We are learning many strange matters from our fresh experience. And besides, there are new conditions of existence which make war as it is with us very different from war as it has been. The first and obvious difference consists in the fact that the whole nation is now penetrated by the ramifications of a network of iron nerves which flash sensation and volition backward and forward, to and from towns and provinces, as if they were organs and limbs of a single living body. The second is the vast system of iron muscles which, as it were, move the limbs of the mighty organism one upon another. What was the railroad force which put the 6th Regiment in Baltimore on the 19th of April but a contraction and extension of the arm of Massachusetts, which with a clenched fist full of bayonets at the end of it? This perpetual intercommunication, joined to the power of instantaneous action, keeps us always alive with excitement. It is not a breathless courier who comes back with a report from an army we have lost sight of for a month, nor a single bulletin which tells us all we are to know for a week of some great engagement, but almost hourly paragraphs, laden with truth or falsehood as the case may be, and making us restless always for the last fact or rumor that they are telling. And so, the movements of our armies. Tonight, the stout lumbermen of Maine are encamped under their own fragrant pines. In a score or two of hours, they are among the tobacco fields and the slave pens of Virginia. The war passion burned like scattered coals of fire in the households of revolutionary times. Now it rushes all through the land like a flame over the prairie. And this instant diffusion of every fact and feeling produces another singular effect in the equalizing and steadying of public opinion. We may not be able to see a month ahead of us, but as to what has happened a week afterwards, it is as thoroughly talked out and judged as it would have been in a whole season before our national nervous system was organized. As the wild tempest wakes the slumbering sea, thou only teachest all that man can be. We indulged in the above apostrophe to war in a Phi Beta Kappa poem of long ago, which we liked better that before we read Mr. Cutler's beautiful prolonged lyric delivered at the recent anniversary of that society. Oftentimes, in paroxysms of peace and goodwill toward all mankind, we have felt twinges of conscience about the passage, especially when one of our orators showed us that a ship of war cost as much to build and keep as a college, and that every porthole we could stop would give us a new professor. Now we begin to think that there was some meaning in our poor couplet. War has taught us, as nothing else could, what we can be and are. It has exalted our manhood and our womanhood, and driven us all back upon our substantial human qualities, for a long time more or less kept out of sight by the spirit of commerce, the love of art, science, or literature, or other qualities not belonging to all of us as men and women. It is at this very moment doing more to melt away the petty social distinctions which keep generous souls apart from each other than the preaching of the beloved disciple himself would do. We are finding out that not only patriotism is eloquence, but that heroism is gentility. All ranks are wonderfully equalized under the fire of a masked battery. The plain artisan or the rough fireman who faces the lead and iron like a man is the truest representative we can show of the heroes of Crécy and Agincourt. And if one of our fine gentlemen puts off his straw-colored kids and stands by the other, shoulder to shoulder, or leads him on to the attack, he is as honorable in our eyes and in theirs as if he were ill-dressed and his hands were soiled with labor. Even our poor Brahmins, whom a critic in ground-glass spectacles, the same who grasps his statistics by the blade and strikes at his supposed antagonist with the handle, oddly confounds with the bloated aristocracy, whereas they are very commonly pallid, undervitalized, shy, sensitive creatures, whose only birthright is an aptitude for learning. Even these poor New England Brahmins of ours, subverts of an organizable base as they often are, count as full men, if their courage is big enough for the uniform which hangs so loosely about their slender figures. A young man was drowned not very long ago in the river running under our windows. A few days afterwards, a field piece was dragged to the water's edge and fired many times over the river. We asked a bystander, who looked like a fisherman, what that was for. It was to break the gall, he said, and so bring the drowned person to the surface. A strange physiological fancy and a very odd non sequitur, but that is not our present point. A good many extraordinary objects do really come to the surface when the great guns of war shake the waters, as when they roared over Charleston Harbor. Treason came up, hideous, fit only to be huddled into its dishonorable grave. But the wrecks of precious virtues, which had been covered up with the waves of prosperity, came up also. And all sorts of unexpected and unheard of things, which had lain unseen during our national life of 80 years, came up and are coming up daily, shaken from their bed by the concussions of the artillery bellowing about us. It is a shame to own it, but there were persons otherwise respectable, not unwilling to say that they believed the old valor of revolutionary times had died out from among us. They talked about our own northern people as the English in the last centuries used to talk about the French. Goldsmith's old soldier, it may be remembered, called one Englishman good for 5 of them. As Napoleon spoke of the English again as a nation of shopkeepers, so these persons affected to consider the multitude of their countrymen as unwarlike artisans, forgetting that Paul Revere taught himself the value of liberty in working upon gold, and Nathaniel Green fitted himself to shape armies in the labor of forging iron. These people have learned better now. The bravery of our free working people was overlaid, but not smothered, sunken, but not drowned. The hands which had been busy conquering the elements had only to change their weapons and their adversaries, and they were as ready to conquer the masses of living force opposed to them as they had been to build towns, to dam rivers, to hunt whales, to harvest ice, to hammer brute matter into every shape civilization can ask for. Another great fact came to the surface and is coming up every day in new shapes, that we are one people. It is easy to say that a man is a man in Maine or Minnesota, but not so easy to feel it all through our bones and marrow. The camp is deprovincializing us very fast. Brave Winthrop, marching with the city élégant, seems to have been a little startled to find how wonderfully human were the hard-handed men of the 8th Massachusetts. It takes all the nonsense out of everybody, or ought to do it, to see how fairly the real manhood of a country is distributed over its surface. And then, just as we are beginning to think our own soil has a monopoly of heroes as well as of cotton, turns up a regiment of gallant Irishmen, like the 69th, to show us that continental provincialism is as bad as that of Coos County, New Hampshire, or of Broadway, New York. Here, too, side by side in the same great camp, are half a dozen chaplains, representing half a dozen modes of religious belief. When the masked battery opens, does the Baptist lieutenant believe in his heart that God takes better care of him than of his Congregationalist colonel? Does any man really suppose that of a score of noble young fellows who have just laid down their lives for their country, the Humusians are received to the mansion of bliss, and the Homosians translated from the battlefield to the abodes of everlasting woe? War not only teaches what man can be, but it teaches also what he must not be. He must not be a bigot and a fool in the presence of that day of judgment proclaimed by the trumpet which calls to battle, and where a man should have but two thoughts, to do his duty and trust his Maker. Let our brave dead come back from the fields where they have fallen for law and liberty, and if you will follow them to their graves, you will find out what the broad church means. The narrow church is sparing of its exclusive formulae over the coffins wrapped in the flag which the fallen heroes have defended. Very little comparatively do we hear at such times of the dogmas on which men differ. Very much of the faith and trust in which all sincere Christians can agree. It is a noble lesson, and nothing less noisy than the voice of cannon can teach it so that it shall be heard over all the angry cries of theological disputants. Now, too, we have a chance to test the sagacity of our friends and to get at their principles of judgment. Perhaps most of us will agree that our faith in domestic prophets has been diminished by the experience of the last 6 months. We had the notable predictions attributed to the Secretary of State, which so unpleasantly refused to fulfill themselves. We were infested at one time with a set of ominous-looking seers, who shook their heads and muttered obscurely about some mighty preparations that were making to substitute the rule of the minority for that of the majority. Organizations were darkly hinted at. Some thought our armories would be seized. And there are not wanting ancient women in the neighboring university town who consider that the country was saved by the intrepid band of students who stood guard, night after night, over the G.R. cannon and the pile of balls in the Cambridge arsenal. As a general rule, it is safe to say that the best prophecies are those which the sages remember after the event prophesied has come to pass. Those who are rash enough to predict publicly beforehand commonly give us what they hope, or what they fear, or some conclusion from an abstraction of their own, or some guess founded on private information, not half so good as what everybody gets who reads the papers. Never by any possibility a word that we can depend on, simply because there are cobwebs of contingency between every today and tomorrow that no field glass can penetrate when 50 of them lie woven over one another. Prophecy as much as you like, but always hedge. Say that you think the rebels are weaker than is commonly supposed, but, on the other hand, that they may prove to be even stronger than is anticipated. Say what you like, only don't be too peremptory and dogmatic. We know that wiser men than you have been notoriously deceived in their predictions in this very matter. Ibis et redibus nunquam et bello paribus. Let that be your model, and remember, on the peril of your reputation as a prophet, not to put a stop before or after the nunquam. There are two or three facts connected with time, besides that already referred to, which strike us very forcibly in their relation to the great events passing around us. We spoke of the long period seeming to have elapsed since this war began. The buds were then swelling which held the leaves that are still green. It seems as old as time himself. We cannot fail to observe how the mind brings together the scenes of today and those of the old revolution. We shut up 80 years into each other like the joints of a pocket telescope. When the young men from Middlesex dropped in Baltimore the other day, it seemed to bring Lexington and the other 19th of April close to us. War has always been the mint in which the world's history has been coined, and now every day or week or month has a new metal for us. It was Warren that the first impression bore in the last great coinage. If it is Ellsworth now, The new face hardly seems fresher than the old. All battlefields are alike in their main features. The young fellows who fell in our earlier struggle seemed like old men to us until within these few months. Now we remember that they were like these fiery youth we are cheering on as they go to the fight. It seems as if the grass of our bloody hillside was crimsoned but yesterday, and the cannonball embedded in the church tower would feel warm if we laid our hand upon it. Nay, in this our quickened life, we feel that all the battles from earliest time to our own day, where right and wrong have grappled, are but one great battle, varied with brief pauses or hasty bivouacs upon the field of conflict. The issues seem to vary, but it is always a right against a claim, and however the struggle of the hour may go, a movement onward of the campaign, which uses defeat as well as victory to serve its mighty ends. The very implements of our warfare change less than we think. Our bullets and cannonballs have lengthened into bolts like those which whistled out of the old arralests. Our soldiers fight with weapons, such as are pictured on the walls of Theban tombs, wearing a newly invented headgear as old as the days of the pyramids. Whatever miseries this war brings upon us, it is making us wiser, and, we trust, better. Wiser, for we are learning our weaknesses, our narrowness, our selfishness, our ignorance, and lessons of sorrow and shame. Better, because all that is noble in men and women is demanded by the time, and our people are rising to the standard the time calls for. For this is the question the hour is putting to each of us. Are you ready, if need be, to sacrifice all that you have and hope for in this world, that the generations to follow you may inherit a whole country whose natural condition shall be peace, and not a broken province, which must live under the perpetual threat, if not in the constant presence, of war and all that war brings with it? If we are all ready for this sacrifice, battles may be lost, but the campaign and its grand object must be won. Heaven is very kind in its way of putting questions to mortals. We are not abruptly asked to give up all that we most care for, in view of the momentous issues before us. Perhaps we shall never be asked to give up all, but we have already been called on to part with much that is dear to us, and should be ready to yield the rest as it is called for. The time may come when even the cheap public print shall be a burden our means cannot support, and we can only listen in the square that was once the marketplace to the voices of those who proclaim defeat or victory. Then there will be only our daily food left. When we have nothing to read and nothing to eat, it will be a favorable moment to offer a compromise. At present, we have all that nature absolutely demands. We can live on bread and the newspaper. The end. The Latin quote toward the end of this article, Ibis et redibus nunquam in bello paribus, I didn't recognize not speaking Latin, but it has two opposite meanings depending on where you pause in the sentence. One meaning is, you will go, you will return, never in war will you perish. It can also mean, you will go, you will never return, in the war, you will perish. So the ambiguity of these predictions are an example of how prophets have to keep the ambiguity of their sayings in order to remain prophets. So anyway, thank you for listening and have a very good week.